HTXT AfriCast is sponsored by Neotel, South Africa's first converged communications network operator. Neotel, inspiring possibilities.
I'm here for the HTXT AfriCast. We're at the African School for Excellence in Shakane. Is it Shakane Township?
Shakane Township.
And I'm joined by Jay and Mahlapa, who helped to found the school. And it's a place that's quite different to many township schools, isn't it?
It's a place that's very special, and I think it's a different, but not so different. And I think we represent the fire, the spark, one would call it, that exists in our township areas. And we've been able to capture that spark and sort of bring it to life and fully sort of, I don't know, explore it and live in it.
Yeah, Nontlatla and I founded African School for Excellence. We opened this first school in 2013 with the goal of basically reinventing low-cost education, to come up with a new method of teaching and learning, a new classroom design that could provide, we talk about world-class, affordable, scalable, something that is at the quality of the very best schools in the country and the best schools in the world, affordable to kids in the township in a financially sustainable way, and scalable to townships all over the country. So this is the first one of we hope, many. And the scholars, as you see around here, the curiosity, the excitement, and you know, these kids on their testing, they're scoring right now better than the people at the top 10% economically of South Africa's youth. Despite, you know, coming from the bottom two, bottom two quintiles of, you know, economically. So it's really, we're really trying to show, as Nontlatla said, that actually the talent's there. These kids are capable. These kids are, and they'll run through brick walls to learn. They're super excited. And, you know, if you put the right environment in place and give them the right chance, then, you know, the sky's the limit. They can do amazing things.
And I'm here today because there's an open day, and I'm surrounded by drones and homemade drones, 3D printers, Arduino boards, and people teaching Python programming, and it's all very really, really clever, advanced, and fun stuff. I mean, is this the sort of thing you do every day here? Is
that... We do focus a lot on world-class, high-quality education, so we try and do all the fun stuff, all the advanced stuff, because our kids are capable of accessing, capable of achieving greatness. We just want to create the right spaces. So in terms of having such awesome people come through, it's not on the regular to have as many of them, but one would argue our staff and our kids are off top class as well. Yeah,
I mean, no, we don't have people coming in and showing us how to use, sending planes across the township and everything every day.
Yeah.
But, we do, our kids come to school on Saturdays, pretty much every Saturday. They come to study and they come, and so that's not an unusual thing. And what I will say is the excitement and the curiosity and everything is something that our kids always have. So it's great to be able to bring things in that are cutting edge in the world, that, and give these kids in Sakane who really, you know, react so well to it, and give them that opportunity to really learn about the cutting edge of technology.
Right, and I think one would argue what's being introduced or what's being shown to some of them today is slightly above their cognitive level, but you still see them fully engaged, and it also speaks to how we teach. We always, by design, our model is designed in such a way that sometimes some things will be introduced in a sort of slightly higher cognitive level, but that's how you get kids learning, that's how you get them engaged and get them taking ownership of their learning and continuing to inform the high quality that we speak so high.
Because I mean that's a big debate in South African education at the moment, isn't it? I mean, how do you get every school up to the level of the best schools without dragging the schools that are already there down? Because there is that focus on not leaving children behind. I mean, presumably that's How would you say you guys tackle that? Is it about the attitude of the staff more than the actual syllabus? Or
I think it's for us the two are intertwined. By design, we have put systems in place that separate our different aspects of the learning process, so that instead of having the teacher trying to do all the things at once, kids are stepping into a classroom in the beginning. I like describing it as, I see education as building, you're constantly trying to build a mansion. Right. And the only way for you to try and build a mansion, you first have to start with a foundation. You have to dig your own foundation. And how we design things, as you see, each classroom, each setting will have three classroom clusters. And they start off in a classroom setup, which we call, at least for math, we'll call it team math. And this is where I tend to describe it as you're digging your own foundation. Now, this is where kids will be getting exposed to different type problems, and which tend to be slightly above the cognitive level, but they're having to work in their teams. And the instruction there is, you're going to get it wrong, but you need to try and attempt it. You need to try and figure it out. And as they engage, half the time, the kids actually sometimes get it. And then that's where they're learning key sort of problem-solving skills and the analytical type skills. And I see that as sort of building, sort of digging that foundation, because that's when you start asking the questions like, so I have this math problem. I have this circle and a square within a circle. How do I calculate the area? I'm given nothing. What's the length of this line? That's when the questions start coming up. And then when they move from that classroom to the classroom now, which we term the instructional class with the skilled teacher, they've already started asking the question. Now, the teacher is, one would argue, the skilled bricklayer, the skilled builder. Now, with the help of the kids coming in, having laid their own foundation, stepping into the class with the teacher now, they're able to build up their walls. And then when they go from there, there's a classroom, this is heavily on the tech side, which we call independent math. Now, having learned the different things that they learned, you're never sure that you know what you know until you've been tested. Now, the tech aspect allows us to be able to test more frequently with sort of shorter feedback loops. Kids can come in, log into Khan Academy, do the module. If we're doing fractions and then just introduced fractions, I'm going in and I'm on my own working at my own pace. But if I'm getting stuck, I'm able to reach out to you, my peer, or the academic advisor in the room. So by design, we are sort of leveraging this skilled teacher with few non-skilled teachers and be able to bring up the level of education to the point where we wanted to. And that's
In terms of sort of traditional ratios, what's the ratio of children to teachers here? Is that
so? If you look at it, bird's eye view, our teacher to student ratio is higher. Student to teacher ratio is higher. So one teacher to 75 kids.
Oh, wow.
But the teacher is only dealing with a subset of kids at any given time. That foundation layering of bricks and perhaps the last class one would say putting up the roof type of setup is all separated. It's all segmented. Yeah. At any given point, we have 20 to 25 kids in a class. And the other two classrooms in which are peer-based or technology-based are being facilitated by teachers in training whom we call academic advisors. Mm-hmm. And those provide a support function to the teacher. So whilst the ratio is much higher, which informs sort of our financial model, the actual class size is much smaller, and we're able to maintain that intimate setup of the classroom to be able to give kids that added attention.
There are two more implications with that I just want to talk about. One is, as I saw you talking with Yvonne and Catlejo and Cliff earlier, is that they're in development now and becoming very, very good teachers. So we have very frequent observation and feedback in the classroom. We videotape lessons. We see all these things, you know, so that people get better much, much more quickly. So, you know, you're not going to scale great education without scaling great teaching. And so we work a lot on improving the teaching in all the classrooms, and by setting up a system that allows us to have senior teachers and teachers in training both operating effectively, it can bring up better teachers. The other thing I wanted to say just about Nortlandla's last point on the problem-solving session, the team math, the different things we do. One of the things you notice today is when the planes come around or the 3D printers, the kids will ooh and ah for a little bit. But then pretty soon, they're saying, wait, how does this work?
Yeah.
Wait, is this going like that? I think, and then if you ask them, they'll say, I think that the hand works like this because we have the strings, and this is, you know, and this is how this fits, and, you know, and sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, but it's a mindset that we focus a lot on, is instilling this idea of, you know, this isn't magic, right? You can figure out how to do it, and if you're working hard enough on it, and those type of thinking skills we do work on every day, mm-hmm. and you see that today the thinking skills are further developing, but you see the point where, you know, where they are.
I did notice that earlier. I saw you interacting with a couple of the kids there, Jay, and it wasn't, you know, one of them was showing you the robo hand, which of course was designed up in Centurion, and Richard Van Ars is here showing off his 3D printers and stuff, and it wasn't just a question of that's amazing, it looks brilliant, what can it be used for? It was you were sort of encouraging them to think about how it's made and why it works in the way it does, which I think is often lost in the...
Well, and that's something we do with every topic, right? So if we're teaching the area of a triangle, why is the area of a triangle 1/2 base times the height, right? Why don't just learn the formula? Why is that, right? Can we prove that? Can we, right? And everything from, so that's a natural question that they're used to getting every day, right? Why does this happen? Why does this work? And trying to think about it, trying to figure it out.
And the thing is, I think going forward, long term, that's how education should be, in my opinion. Because if we're going to focus on this is the formula, this is how you do it, this is how you apply it, then someone gives it to you the next time with things slightly different, you're not able to fully apply those skills. And I think if we're developing kids to be able to do well, not just in school, but in general and in life, and our ambition is that our kids should be able to step into any university in the world and do well, it starts here, and it starts with that.
I mean, we've talked a lot about sort of maths and STEM subjects, and we've obviously got the electronics and mechanical engineers here today doing the workshops. Would you say that STEM subjects are a specialism here, or does that the same philosophy apply across languages and social sciences as well?
Yes. The exact same philosophy applies to the humanities subjects as well. They do English, they do history, and the thing is, we tend to not speak as much about the English, but it's they do a writing assignment at least 3 or 4 times a day, because it's quite tough for us to expect them to do well in the STEM subjects if they don't know how to read and write. If you can't access the information, then it's quite tough. So that is also sort of a keen focus of ours.
But it's the same type of thinking about how to do things, where Nathalie said was, you know, you have problem solving and creative problem solving skills, you have high quality teaching, and you have lots of practice, mm-hmm. right? And so those type of things, you know, it gets you. So our eighth graders this year were reading Shakespeare, and when they joined us in grade 7, on international standards, they were reading at a grade 3 level, right? But you don't get there, again, it's not magic. You get there by lots of reading, lots of writing, lots of feedback on the process, and how, you know, and you see very, you know, very rapid improvement. And so our improvement on English is as rapid, I'd say, as our improvement in mathematics.
Right. And I think we're starting to, especially for these kids in the areas that we target, we're starting to encourage kids to read for pleasure. I remember one of the kids, I don't think he's here today, Iketsang, when we ran the Accelerate program next door and had to interview and post the program. And his favorite class was this class we call independent reading, where it's basically in that room, the kids come in and they pick a reading, either a paragraph or book or whatever poem, whatever they choose to read, and then they just sit down and read.
Because that's one of the big problems with education at the moment in South Africa, and I've spoken to a lot of people about this, is the establishment of a reading culture, and it just doesn't exist, particularly in townships, but I think across all levels of society at the moment.
It's something I think our kids are hungry for, because I remember when I spoke to him about it, he said, I asked him, why is independent reading your favorite? You could ask him as well. He said, I get to go on adventures, and that's such a it's such an important thing. And our kids, especially in township areas and the rest of the country, are in such difficult situation. If you can give them the hope of a book and being able to read it and just escape and lock everything out, that's amazing. And that's also what they're able to develop through the English program.
Yeah. We have assemblies every day, and one of them is in terms of establishing the culture, we call Funda Thursday, which is their that sometimes faculty members, more often kids, are coming and just talking about what they're reading on their own. This is the latest thing I read, or sometimes it's writing, sometimes it's poetry that they've written. But you know, one day a week where we're coming in, and this is what I've been reading completely apart from school on my own. This is what I'm doing, and just developing that culture all the time. It's really, you know, really important part of what we do.
One of the other things I noticed, I mean, sort of tying in with this theme of sort of building a Renaissance army in a way, it feels like you're doing it. You address them as scholars rather than pupils or students or learners, which I hear a lot in South Africa. What's the theory behind that?
I think you learn, you continue to learn every day in your life. So even when they finish matric and when they finish university, they'll continue to be scholars. We refer to academics quite a lot by scholars. Why can't we refer to the kids as scholars? Because we're doing the same thing.
Yeah, and it's about how you carry yourself, right, and how you think about yourself. So it's a mindset shift we want to make with our scholars, that you think of yourself as a person who is going on and doing these things, and then you can build into that. And it has to do with how you behave, how you study, how you do this, how you do that. So that's why the nomenclature we use. Scholars is one example, but across lots of different things is different than what exists elsewhere.
Right. Because it helps quite a lot with pushing for mastery, if anything.
Sorry, there was one other quick point I wanted to make on a question that you asked about this debate in South Africa about leaving children behind, and how can you, this idea that if you're going to try to educate everyone, then good schools are going to get worse no matter what you do,
because
some kids just can't do it. So first of all, most of our kids, if you see the scores, you see the scores when they arrived, they would have been put in that category of, these kids are too slow, they can't do it, you need to have different expectations for them, right? You look at them now, and everyone will say, oh, they're so smart, you just have smart, right? And it's like, well, that's because, you know, they were reading at a third grade level, now they're scoring in the top 2 or 3% in the country. It's, you know, they're the same kids, right? What I believe in is, one, honesty with kids about what things take, and also I don't want to make judgments about what a child is willing to do, right? So this, to me, that is a big problem where you say, well, Nontlantla is not capable of doing it because, and if I say, what would it take? What would she have to do? Well, she'd have to study for 5 hours a night and this and that. Maybe she's willing to do that. Right? You don't know that until you sit and tell her, this is what it's going to take to, you know, and if it's going to take, then you can find out whether she's willing to do it or not. And what we find is the assumption gets made, oh, the kids aren't willing to do that. And we tell them, and we find out, you know what? They are willing to do it. So for us, it's not really a question of, oh, this child's not capable, that child's not capable. That never happens, actually. It's okay, on an individual basis, what is it going to take for you to make it? Okay, you're going to have to read a book every week. You're going to have to do this, you're going to have to do that, and that's what it'll take for you to reach our bar, right? You're going to have to go home and study this many, you know, do this many math exercises, and if you're willing to do that, you'll be okay, and if you won't, then you won't reach it. And what we find is kids do it, right? Parents will push them, kids will work, kids, and they'll do it, and then, you know, by doing that extra hard work, that's how they make it.
That's an interesting sort of follow-up to that. I mean, you mentioned the parents briefly there.
Yeah.
I mean, do you work quite hard with the parents and the rest of the community to get their buy-in to the teaching ethics? Or?
It's amazing. I can relay a story to you about that one. I think we have an amazing group of parents. The site that you see right now, when we had our first recruitment meeting in November 2012, we launched our school in 2013. November 2012, we bring in the parents. Early November, bring in the parents, introducing the head of school. All these structures, what you see here, was not here. We only had the marquee, rented flooring, and it was just mud. And we had started doing earthworks and we started clearing. But the parents were there. The parents were supportive and they have continued to be. Instead, I think the main complaint that I get when I interact with them is, you guys are not using us. Let us do more.
Yeah. I mean, the question you asked, I was laughing as the way you worded it, because do you work hard with the parents to get buy-in? The answer to the first part is yes. We work hard with the parents. To get buy-in, no. That we already have. That's like that. They're ready to do it.
Because I find it an interesting debate, particularly when we visit schools where they're implementing technology and one tablet per child, and it always seems to come back to this thing that it's you've got to get the whole family to understand where the school's going to a certain extent, and that's difficult in a lot of places where there's a high level of absentee parents or orphans and so on. It's difficult.
We do have orphans, but in the events that they're orphans, they'll live with a grandma or a relative or whoever. I think the communities that we focus and we target on really do appreciate the value of high quality education. As soon as you show them this is what I'm bringing in, the accelerated program, the programs we run over the holidays, gives parents a chance to fully scrutinize us and see exactly what it is we promise. And by the time we say we're coming into the community and this is what we're doing, they're always just saying, or they'll come in and say, when exactly are you coming? I think as soon as you properly pitch what we're doing as it is, providing world-class secondary school education to our young people, the conversation changes. It then becomes, so where can I help? How can I assist?
So I know you've got to go off and feed these hungry kids at some point today, and they're all starving and queuing up for their lunch already. So just two very quick questions to round up with about the sort of background. I mean, obviously, what you're doing here is quite radical in terms of the South African education system as a whole. Mm-hmm. You've only been here for 18 months?
18 months.
18 months, yeah.
We started testing our sort of innovative classroom design in the middle of 2011, and so we've run lots of programs testing that, but then our first full-time school opened.
So where did the theories come from and the ideas come from? I mean, is this something that people are trying overseas as well, or is it completely developed here and a very unique structure?
See, it's somewhat very unique, and I'll answer this because I'm not from an education background. I'm from a science background, and when I talk to the education kids, recruiting academic advisors and teachers for Accelerate program, and I describe how we're doing, the education students always see a light bulb, and they're like, that is the theory that I was learning in class. So in terms of what we're doing, it isn't as radical. It is something that's been researched, that's been is there, but in terms of the design and layering and how we've done things, there is some slight difference there. But what we're implementing is what's being taught to its students right now.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say if you think about each of the pieces that Nontlahla was describing to you, the cognitive conflicts, the teaching, the deliberate practice, these are all pieces, as you said, that have very deep research behind them, right? So, where she mentioned this is a little bit beyond kids' development. It's because this sort of Lev Vygotsky zone of proximal development is where you need to be to get the best, to get the best development. And there's lots of Michael Shayer and research, beyond that on how that works. The specifics of how it's put together don't come from any place else because it's designed with a specific goal in mind for a specific community, right? Which is to say, like I said, the question was, how can we deliver world-class education that township kids can afford, right, and that we can scale throughout townships, which is actually a question that when we started looking at it in 2010, I couldn't find anyone else asking that question. So if you ask a slightly different question, you come to a slightly different answer using the same research, right? So we have certain disadvantages. We have to make this less expensive than any of the models that exist in the UK or the US or that are being done. Ours is less expensive, right? But we also have advantages that they wouldn't have over there, which is that, for example, as we've talked about, our kids will run through brick walls to learn. We can put them in a room and give them a couple of problems and say, this will be good, work on it. And you don't need a great, great teacher who has tons of... You put someone in the room who's never taught before, who's just there because they're 12, right, to make sure that... And it works. It's better as the person learns to teach better, but it works because these kids are disciplined and they work hard, and it's sort of specific to actually the South African township cultural environment. So I think, we take the strengths and use those to sort of counteract some of the difficulties. in this specific, you know, in the specific environment. So that's the way it comes from things that exist, but it's new here.
And on the you say it's got to be affordable, it's got to cost less than the solutions that are out there. What is the funding model? I mean, where did you find the capital to start? And do the parents pay a fee here, or is it DBE supported? Yeah. Or?
I'll answer that. We have our short term and our long term funding model. So our cost to educate, going up to next year, it's going from 600 to 700 rand a month, which is a little more than half what the government spends to educate a child. That's still too much for many of our parents, so we subsidize much of that with either individual scholarships funded by individuals across South Africa and across the world who pay two-thirds of that tuition. We're hoping next year that we may be able to get a government subsidy, which is they'll give subsidies of up to 60% of what they spend, which that gets us to break even, right? If we have that plus the 200 rand a month and potentially up a bit from parents, then that gets us to break even, and we can scale based on that. Startup costs, right, including the buildings here and things, which every young organization and startup needs, we're getting now. We have basically committed South Africans who are looking for a solution to education challenges in the country and are supporting us to get started to see if we can make this work.
And I know the DBE is doing a lot of work at the moment in terms of evaluating particularly technology in schools and what the best way to get computer labs into schools is and things like that. I mean, are they sort of watching what you're doing here with any interest, or are you sort of out in the...
Spoken with them more recently. Yeah.
I have. I think we continue to establish and develop that relationship and grow going forward. I'd say that the district director of Ekurhuleni East recently, I met with her last week, and she's very excited. She's keen, and she said, I want to see how this paperless classroom thing works, because we're looking into implementing it. So that relationship is still sort of being groomed. We're young enough that we're like tiny little fish, but we're still growing, and we see ourselves as agents of change that should be informing and working with DBE. So the answer there is yes.
you mentioned paperless classroom there. I mean, you're not paperless at the moment, are you?
No, but the third classroom that I described when going through my house analogy, the third classroom, which we call independent math, independent science, is for independent practice. By design, we've put things in systems in place such that should be a tech-based classroom where kids can pace themselves and be able to, our scholars be able to practice through material and get more immediate feedback. I mean, that's what paperless systems allow you to do and take away the burden of having to grade papers for teachers, but also with a good management system, you're able to get the data at the big end, so that makes things more efficient and much, much easier.
So we have parts that are paperless and parts that are not. We are exploring always changing that how much is paperless and how much isn't, right? What we've said is, for us, technology is one important tool for a good education. It's not the good education in itself, right? So we look at the entire learning process that that our scholar is going through to get from point A to point B. What are the different activities they need to do? Okay. And then what is the most efficient, least expensive, most effective way for us to administer those activities? In some cases, that's a really high-quality teacher in a room with 20 students talking about Shakespeare, right? And sometimes that's what you have to do. You know, that's the most expensive way to do things. But in certain cases, that's what you have to do. And in other places, you can use technology, you can use peer learning, you can use those are the two main tools. But you can use different types of things to leverage those teachers across more scholars. So we've designed something to say, okay, knowing that the best, probably both the best hardware and the best software that we will want to use 5 years from now, I would guess, doesn't exist yet, right? So rather than create something based on the iPad or based on this or based on what, right, we say, okay, we want to have a system that can adapt and improve as the trends in technology continue. So as the software becomes more readily available and better, right? And as the hardware becomes cheaper and higher quality, we can then incorporate more, right? So 2 years ago, when we were starting this, having a having a tablet per scholar and using that for everything was not feasible. It was too expensive, and when we started getting down to things that you could pay for, the quality was such we couldn't do it. That's starting to change, and so we may shift. But we've always had as part of our goal. Okay, as these things happen, we'll shift with them, and we'll design a system that can get better and get cheaper as these things happen. Right. So right now it's one out of three that's paperless, but that'll change, which is why they're
interested. I mean, the interesting part of us is some of us, I started school in 94. Some people started school very early. a lot of things have changed from when I was in school. I'm willing to bet a lot of things have changed since Jay was in school. And yet, our South Africa, our classrooms haven't changed. And our classrooms need to change because our young people are different. There are different ways in which they engage to how people in the 80s engaged, and we're making sure that we're able to
I'd go even further than that. I mean, when you say the tablets and the hardware and software that they're going to be using in a couple of years' time doesn't exist yet, I mean, the jobs that they're going to be going to in a couple of years' time don't exist yet. It's just impossible to predict, isn't it?
Which is why it's all about teaching the thinking skills, right? The skills that we know will matter, regardless of what, there's all this talk about 21st century skills, and we're teaching those 21st century skills. But a lot of those are the same skills that were 19th century and 18th century, 1st century skills, right? Problem solving skills, cognitive reasoning, right? Analytical thinking, communication, reading and writing. These skills, regardless of what happens, these are going to be very important, and people who do those things really well are going to succeed, and people who don't do those things really well won't succeed. That's the case now. That's been the case. That's been the case for as long as we know. It will continue to be, right? So we focus on those things, and technology helps us to do that, and we do care about them understanding computers for computer's sake and things, but the big thing is teaching those things really well, because if we know if we do that, then the world is their oyster no matter what happens.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your time. I shall let you get back to it now. And what a lovely morning this has been. Thank you very much.
The HDXT AfriCast is sponsored by Neotel, South Africa's first converged communications network operator. Neotel, inspiring possibilities.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.